UFO Paranormal and UFO Radio. Tonight we have with us Brooks Agnew, the author of The Ark of Millions of Years. And we're also very fortunate to have him in our Ancient Mysteries MS group. So welcome to the show, Brooks.
Thank you very much, Mary.
And we'll just get started right off by telling our listeners a little bit about your book, and then I'll just kind of like break in and ask you some questions that I've been dying to ask you as well.
Sure. Well, The Ark of Millions of Years is primarily a nonfiction book. It's a combination of physics and religious archaeology, written with a tremendous flair and style to describe the creation of the Earth. Actually, its age, its origin, the condition it is in right now, and its ultimate destiny. And, of course, in that book we cover not only the formation of the Earth, the relocation of the Earth from its place of formation to its present orbit, and also the birth, life, and destruction of several races that have existed on the Earth besides man.
And, you know, that is so difficult. There has been such a cover-up to keep us from knowing about these ancient races before us and the ages that have come and gone before modern man.
Well, that's absolutely true. As we were doing our research, we actually stumbled upon a relationship in some ancient texts. We draw upon the Zohar and the Kabbalah and the Popol Vuh, and many of these have really never been correlated together. But my co-author, who is E.J. Clark, is an expert on ancient documents and has personally crawled over the pyramids and the ruins in South America. She's gone in the caves. She's done painstaking research on the glyphs. And what we discovered was something that's actually been lost for over 5,000 years, and that is the key to understanding the presence of these races and the development of the Earth. So it may be a cover-up, yes, but it's a cover-up that goes back several hundred years.
If not further.
Yeah, if not further. Somewhere along the line, some church government decided what the people should know and what they should not know.
Well, you know, the Smithsonian went to a lot of trouble in the 1800s, I believe it was, to actually destroy, to send people out, get this evidence, and it either got buried, and there's actually been reports that they've taken, like, as far as the evidence of the giants and actually put them on barges and taken them out into the ocean and dumped it.
Absolutely true. And they put a bounty on some of these ancient records, and I think you've heard of a set of records called the Nag Hammadi texts.
Yes.
That's actually named for the system of caves in which they were found. But they were actually found just prior to World War II, but the bounty on them was so high that they went on the black market and literally disappeared for 20 years.
Oh, is that what happened to them?
We still don't have all of them.
So where do you think they are, private collections?
Well, they're in private collections, or as you say, people in authority have confiscated them and destroyed them or locked them away.
And why?
Well, the same reason that it happens in all ages. Knowledge is power, and the leadership of the day does not want the people to be empowered. They want the people to be beholden to their system, to their leadership, and not to be able to defy them or circumvent them in any way.
Well, now, you know, the United States has always tried to, have given the impression to the people that we have prided ourselves in freedoms of information, freedom of speech. But that would not be a freedom of speech if it's been taken away from us.
I don't know very many Americans that aren't at least a little suspicious of that freedom of information. Sure, we have freedom of information for the items that are on the main floor, but the things that are in the basement and the things that are behind the safe, there's no freedom of information.
Now, you said that you found the key.
Yes.
That's exciting. tell us about
And I
that.
Wish I would love to go into details of the key on this radio broadcast, mm-hmm. but I would really like people to buy the book and read it and find out the key for themselves. But
how did they get the book?
Oh, you can buy it at any online bookseller: Amazon, Borders, Books a Million, Barnes and Noble. We are getting it out in the local bookstores. Some of the independents are carrying it now, but it was just published in November of last year, so our marketing and distribution networks are just now catching up with demand.
Uh-huh.
But if you want a copy, you can certainly go to those areas or go to the publisher's website at authorhouse.com or to our website, arcofmillionsofyears.com.
Oh, okay. Now, I was looking for that website yesterday, and, okay, what is it? It's www.what?
arcofmillionsofyears.com.
Ark
like Noah's Ark.
Of millions. Millions of years.com. Okay. And that's an ARC, A-R-C or A-R-K?
A-R-K.
Oh, I spelled it wrong.
A-R-C would be a segment of a circle.
Yeah. Leave it to me. And okay, but you're going to give us a little bit tonight, though, right?
Sure.
Okay, good.
I know you're hot.
It makes for a difficult show if we can't get any information here.
Well, I know your audience is particularly interested in the chapter called The Giants.
Uh-huh.
And we have discovered all of the tribes of the giants and their origin.
All the tribes?
Yes. I don't think we've left any out. We've listed their genealogy in the book.
Now, the giants are from the elves, am I correct?
Yeah, the giants actually are not human. They actually came to the earth originally as a group known in the scriptures called the Watchers. And they're mentioned, well, for instance, in Genesis, they're called the Nephilim. Their tribes, I could list them in alphabetical order, but they're quite numerous. A couple of the names you might be familiar with, in one of the threads on your Ancient Mysteries website, we have been discussing, and I misspoke in your thread, I called him King Daniel. It was actually King David of David and Goliath days. He actually employed the gibberim, that's G-I-B-B-O-R-I-M, or translated mighty men, as his body and palace guards. And some were even made captain over his armies. And when David was a fugitive, he gathered around him 600 of these gibberim for protection. Now, these men were, according to the information we've been able to discover, between 9 and 12 feet tall. Some of them weighed over 400 pounds. They were mighty warriors and extremely intelligent. They could run barefooted as fast as a horse, and they could cleave a man in two with one blow from his collarbone to his pelvis. So they were very, very feared, even among large armies. That's why David was able to escape and to survive as long as he did. But
in my reading on when David escaped, it said that he took some of his faithful followers, mm-hmm. and then he went to the land of the Palestinians.
Yes.
And these were this group here.
Right. And, of course, David was one of the most powerful kings in history, and he's also one of the few kings that had true divine endorsement. And this endorsement, well, it's probably the only thing on the planet that was more powerful than the rule of the giants. Now, one thing that's peculiar to giants is they have six fingers, six toes, and multiple rows of teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the gibberim spoke a language that was impossible for men to speak because it requires several rows of teeth to speak the language. And that is the root word for the word gibberish, which we know in our language is unspeakable language.
Uh-huh. Yeah, when you brought that up in that thread at Ancient Mysteries MS, I found that quite fascinating that we actually got that word from the giants, gibberish. Yeah.
Well, they lived to be a great age.
Well, we're actually seeing there's regressive genes showing up, you know, in people where we have giant stature men today.
Sure.
and women. We've had people being born with double rows of teeth.
And six fingers and six toes.
Now,
that's one of the mistakes that anthropologists make, is they think that this is a degenerate human gene. It isn't. That's one thing unique about the giant's DNA. Unlike our DNA, their DNA could blend with any animal and produce offspring.
Now, that takes me back to, there's supposed to have been a continent or a race. Well, there was the continent, the Lemurian continent, so then
yes.
The age of the Lemurians. But before that was the, if I remember right, it was there was an age of Pan, right?
Pan. Yeah, we cover that in the chapter called The Lost Civilization of Mu.
Uh-huh, but that was prior to Mu, wasn't it?
Well, actually, Mu was a continent, so
right.
It sunk in three different cataclysms, so it actually had three different ages.
So, Pan was in the age of the Lemurian
yes.
times? And now, that would go back to Greek mythology, where there you would see these demigods as like Pan himself, you know, half man and half goat.
And the Minotaur and things like that. These were actual beings that existed.
And so you're saying that, I think that you're saying is that these type of people came from the elves because they were able to, or they were from the giants who were able to breed into animal or man. Is this
That's
how they came to be?
That's correct.
Because some of us have thought that it was some sort of genetic research, that maybe some high-tech race was actually working with, that was able to produce half-man, half-beast, half-man, half-fish.
You mean through technical genetic engineering?
Right.
It could be, but more than likely it was because the genes of the giants were such that they could, the DNA could blend with any animal. And now, a couple of the peculiar things about the giants, and we see it in the regressive genes that we see when humans grow to that age, is that although they may live a long time, they are subject to a degenerative disease. Half their body becomes paralyzed, while the other half remains vigorous. And, you know, they would, at that point, rather than suffer that kind of invalidism, they would just take a certain herb, throw it into their mouths, and die. And because they killed themselves, they were called Rephaim, or R-E-F-A-I-M, according to, Rabbi Isaac is a well-known authority on this, and he comments in the Zohar. He reports that they used to drown themselves in the sea, as it is written, the Rephaim are slain beneath the waters. That's a good reference in the book. All this is recorded in ancient documents. And if it were just that, I guess people could write it off. But there's hardly a place in the world where bones or fossils of giants have not been discovered.
Especially here in the United States.
Oh,
right
yeah.
Here in North America.
Here in North Carolina,
we have
South Carolina.
Oh, yeah. Ohio. Is they had a lot of great finds of the giants there.
Sure.
And the Indians had their stories that sounds very much like yours, that they were so fast they could run down the horse, the buffalo, whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. But now, so now all of these giants came from one planet, do you think? Or did they? Now, I don't know if you've noticed the thread that we're working with on El Cidonia.
Oh, sure. I know about
Or El Sion, I guess that's how it's in El Sion, where they, now we call it Zion. Do you think that these giants came from there, or were they, it was a mixture of various planets, or?
Well, it's hard to know the original source.
Mm-hmm.
What is fairly evident is that before the flood of Noah, many of the giants left the planet. They had basically accomplished their mission of corrupting the Earth, and they left, and some stayed. Mm-hmm. Probably for a couple of reasons. Either they were left behind, or they were several generations deep into their existence here on the Earth, and perhaps they felt that their association with and service of prophets that were here on the Earth at the time might redeem them. But unfortunately, the atonement that was established was not for them, and they were destroyed in the Flood. Then after the Flood, the Nephilim returned again.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the difference in the genetic makeup, not only of man, but also of sea creatures. There's been a lot of paleobiology that's been done that has shown that there was a sudden advent of new genetic material put into the ecology, for which the Earth needed to strike a new ecological balance.
Which was when? 8,000 years ago?
Well, during the Flood of Noah. There's some controversy as to when that actually occurred.
Okay, because, see, you in our conversation before, you had said 8,000 years ago. But then I got a problem with the 8,000 because it seems that we can almost pinpoint the year or the years of that the pyramids were built and that culture began, and that was 10,500 B.C.
Yeah, 9500 B.C. at least, because the first, well, the last of the three cataclysms occurred 9500 B.C.
But they went according to how it mirrored the stars of Orion.
Sure does. And it actually mirrored them at that day, not this day.
Yeah, right. Which would it take? And they said that when they did their, you know, they put it into computer, for astrology, that the time that it appeared or went back to when the sky looked exactly like how it looked according, you know, to how the pyramids were set up. That was 10,500 B.C.
I thought it was 9,500 B.C., but you could be right. It's difficult for me to remember at this moment, but I thought it was 9,500 B.C.
But of course, and now those the people that taught the Egyptians or the builders at that time were the remnants of Mu, right? Or Atlantis, I should say.
Well, they're actually two different civilizations. They both existed. And they actually competed against each other, and I believe that the leaders that became the first pharaoh, I believe he actually came from Atlantis.
Yeah. Now, I was reading someplace tonight, through one of Phyllis Galdi's magazines, Fate Magazine, that I can't remember who the author was of this editorial or article, but he went on to say that around 8,000 years ago, 10,000 maybe, some, you know, give or take a couple thousand years, there was a war that started, and the war was between the elves and the reptilians, or reptoids,
mm-hmm.
we call them.
Mm-hmm.
And is that in your book?
Yes.
Actually, would this be called the War of the Gods?
Warlike.
Would this be the War of the Gods, or is that a different war?
It's called the War of the Elder Gods.
Mm-hmm.
The reptilians were warlike, and they actually approached the what you call elves. It very well could be, but they were nevertheless a peaceful, although powerful race, and said that they were going to destroy them.
Now, these would be giants, right? The elders?
Yes. And the peaceful ones that were being accosted basically told the reptilian race to go home. They didn't want to fight. But if they persisted, they had no choice but to destroy them. Well, this kind of humored the attacking race because they were already geared up and already had invaded and ready to attack the capital. And I'm trying to search for it here in the book really quickly, but in essence, the peaceful race fired up a weapon and just destroyed the home city of the reptilians. And there are areas where civilizations have been excavated, and they have found whole families of people laying face down holding hands as if they were running from something. And now keep in mind, this is like 9 or 10,000 years BC.
Okay.
And the bones of those people are more radioactive than the bones of the survivor, or the those killed at Hiroshima.
Yeah.
So what was actually set off was some kind of thermonuclear device. Now,
And they feel that that probably happened right over here in the United States too. So that war would seems like it must have been some sort of a world war, because we have our Death Valley, White Sands, you know, the White Sands National Park.
Right.
You know, and
the glass that's associated with a nuclear blast is all over that place.
Yeah.
Now, of course, geologists will have you believe that uranium all by itself can go critical and make a thermonuclear explosion. And I'm a physicist, and I'm here to tell you that the conditions under which that could happen just don't exist here on the Earth.
Yeah, so maybe we should give your credentials here.
Well, I have a PhD in physics. I was educated at Tennessee Technological University. My bachelor's is in chemistry. I've been publishing for around 30 years.
Uh-huh. And I want to discuss that later on in the show, because of the what is it? My mind slips me. The new physics that's gone interdimensional
cosmology.
Yeah.
Kind of a birthing science right now.
Yeah, yeah. But I wanted to touch on that, so don't let me forget. But now, okay, so. See, I'm trying to put this in some sort of a time frame. I found I was so upset the other day. I was watching a show. I was either on the Science Channel or History. I think it was the History Channel, where they were talking about the Bog people. Have you ever heard of them?
The what?
The Bog people, B-O-G.
No.
There was a Bog people that they found. They were excavating some land down in Florida, and a bulldozer unearthed a skeleton, and so they called the archaeologist in, and they had a discovery of a lifetime, you know, something that we have never had before. They found a group of people, a tribe of people that had probably been in existence for 1,200 years, you know, living in that same area, and they had been, their burial tradition was to bury their people underwater. You know, in these bogs, and through the excavation, they were able to date these people back 8,000 years. And what was so remarkable about it is the way that they were preserved. When they found them, they actually found the brain still intact, where they were able to get DNA off of it. And with that, they thought that they'd be able to finally find the origin of the Native American Indian. But lo and behold, there wasn't one Native American here in the United States that fit the DNA of these people.
How about that?
And they were able to, they thought that they were able to determine that they were European. And then in further into the excavation, they came across woven cloth that they were used, you know, so these people actually wove their own clothing made out of cloth. They were able to, they would, like during a funeral, they wrapped their people, you know, in this cloth, you know, as a burial shroud. And then just as things were getting good, the state of Florida decided that they just couldn't finance this anymore and closed down the dig and bulldozed everything back up into the swamp, back into the bogs. And that's been the end of the story. And apparently they had discovered these people in approximately 1980, and it took them 20 years before they even went public with it, I guess, you know. But then after,
I think I heard something somewhere about some stone markers that were found in the forest, and those were being excavated, and they were ordered by the state to be bulldozed in.
Yeah. But I mean, there goes, you know, and then when I talked to you, I was so excited because, you know, you were telling me that something major happened about 8,000 years ago. But then we got these people, and I'm trying to think to myself, did these people come after, you know, that period of time? Was this like a new race that was developed, you know, or had survived? When they analyzed these skulls, they were modern skulls. They wasn't, you know, and they seen signs of, you know, high intelligence.
Well, we know that genetics that showed up with Noah and in the chapter called The Union of the Polarity, we reveal that the age of the Earth is both 4.5 billion years old and 7,000 years old.
Now that's where you got me confused.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of astrophysical theories about how the Earth was formed. Actually, there's more than one, more than 10, but the one that I want to discuss is a theory that came pretty close. And I actually saw it on Discovery Channel not too long ago, where they said that the Earth was a coalesced ball of dust and metal, and then was struck by a heavier iron core, or iron rock, and the rock actually pierced the crust and went into the center of the Earth and became the core of the Earth.
Really?
But the animation that they showed would be impossible. If a planet the size of Earth was struck by something that solid, the Earth would be a unrecognizable part of the asteroid belt. It would have been broken into a gazillion pieces. Actually, what happened was the Earth was developed over a 4.5 billion year period. Several races of humans and humanoids have lived and died on this planet in that period of time. At the same period, in a distant part of the galaxy, we believe close to the center of the galaxy, near one of the larger stars, a water planet was formed and peopled by a different race, a higher race, Noah's race, and then at an appropriate time, that planet was moved through a trans-dimensional process, which we describe in the book, and that ethereal planet was moved across the galaxy and then merged with the current Earth. And instead of going into the center, it enveloped the Earth. And the two together, the 7,000-year-old Earth and the 4.5 billion-year Earth, form almost what could be understood as an organism on which we live.
Really? Now, that would, when I'm hearing this, what I'm thinking of is the Dogons, when they talk about the fish gods.
The bottom line is Noah's Ark wasn't a boat. It was a planet. And it did have all the animals on it.
Noah's Ark was a planet, this watery planet.
Yes.
Do you have a name for that planet?
Just the spiritual Earth.
The spiritual Earth. Now, a lot of people, well, the Native Americans and Mayans and that, they have always said that the Earth is a living organism. And that's what you're saying.
It's in the book.
I know. Unfortunately, I'm waiting. I'm still waiting for my book, and I don't. And again, with arcofmillionsofyears.com, and from there they can find the various places that they can order this book. Right.
Oh, sure. Actually, if you go to the website, you can either click on the cover or one of the links that's there, and you will go to the publisher's buy site, which is about 15% cheaper than buying it at Amazon or Borders or Books A Million.
Mm-hmm.
So you can save a little bit of money by going to the website, but the publisher's website isn't as well known as the online booksellers.
Okay, now, so this waterly planet was, now this was steered to Earth? So this was an intelligent act to put the two together as one and form some sort of a special creation, some sort of a project of sorts by some sort of other species or race,
yes,
right?
Of that there can be no doubt.
And now who would these people be? Would they have been the elves? Would they have been the fish gods that the Dorgans talk of? Which would have been, because of you, if you go back to ancient Egypt mythology, they talk about, what was his name? I can't think of it. Where, you know, the guy comes out of the ocean, out of the water, and teaches during the day, and then at night went back into the sea again. And then you have your Poseidon, your Greek mythology with Poseidon.
And Neptune.
Now, is that connected to what you're talking about, or
it,
no?
What we do, we try not to take sides in this. What we do is we present all those views in the mm-hmm. book, because mm-hmm. all of these are ancient observations and handed down observations from generation to generation. So the Mayans, the Egyptians, in the Quran they have several descriptions, in some Japanese and Chinese texts, which we have glyphs and pictures and symbols that come from those civilizations. They all describe this similar event. Yes, it was an intelligent act. Almost every single ancient race that records this calls that person some form or some name of God. Either God or Allah, or Popol Vuh has several names for it. The ancient Indians have several names for it. So we try not to take sides. We try to present everybody's views. The idea here is to allow evolutionists and creationists to break bread, finally, over the same book, that actually both theories have their merit.
Uh-huh. Well, I've always looked, you know, in my research, I've never turned around and thrown the baby out with the bathwater. I've always looked for common denominators, stories that keep repeating over and over again, regardless of what country they come from, you know, or what myth they come from. And if you can find, I've always looked at, if you can find that common denominator root word, you know, that's where you go with, you know.
Sure. And,
you know.
And it's probably, at least we make the case, for common origin, rather than some teacher that traveled the earth and taught all these civilizations. Actually, these civilizations probably descended from factions of Lemuria or Mu or Atlantis, because these civilizations existed for thousands and thousands of years, and their technology was, well, it surpassed ours.
Yeah.
Their forms of energy, their forms of travel, their forms of communication, their reverence for life on the earth and balance far exceed what we think are our ethics.
Yeah, see, you know, we try to think that we're so advanced right now, and we're still living in superstitions.
I think we're kind of like rock stars. We've achieved such success so quickly that as a race, at this point in our development, we lack maturity mm-hmm. to handle the wealth that's laying at our feet.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tendency to hoard it, and we see such disparity between one land and another land when there is more than enough to spare for everyone on the earth.
But that would take the power away from the elite factors.
As has always been the case. Whether it was the Catholic Church, or the Romans, or the Hittites, or the Persians, or the Gauls, it's always been the same.
I know, I was watching that show last night, Troy. And, you know, and I'm thinking about, you know, like what we're going through in Iraq and that now. And it's like, my God, people, what are you doing?
Well,
you know,
this is the battle of good and evil. There's no doubt about it. You have forces that are culminating in what I believe, and my co-author believes, are the last days. And you have the magnitude of the power of these two forces reaching global proportions, where when the final battle is done, the planet will suffer.
But what is, you know, it's all in our, I agree. I think that these battles, these world wars that we have and that, you know, is just an extension of memories long lost that, and we just, you know, it's like some sort of a primal instinct of sorts that we've forgotten why, but we just keep on going with the battle.
That may be, but I think it goes beyond that. I think there are actually metaphysical forces that inspire and drive men who are susceptible to these kinds of forces to do the things that they do.
Uh-huh.
I think that men and women are being, if they are weak of will or seeking power through greed or lust, they're empowered by these metaphysical forces. I think those forces are very, very real.
And how do you base this? You said that now you're a physicist, and so naturally you try to base everything on fact.
Sure. Well, one of the things that has become evident in the last couple of decades, Dr. Michio Kaku or Dr. Kip Thorne have written in their technical papers, at great risk to their own reputations, the existence of parallel universes.
Uh-huh.
There are a lot of books out on it right now. We see the ripples of it as the two universes sort of brush up against each other, but we haven't yet discovered the way to slip from our universe into another universe.
But there has been those that have been able to.
Both ways.
Not us, of course, but...
I don't know that that's true either.
Yeah.
I think there may be some on this planet that have mastered that ability.
Yeah. But I mean us as on a whole, you know, as far as
no, we
human
don't do
race.
It for recreational use.
Yeah.
But the things that we are doing on this planet affect the universe.
Yeah.
And if they affect our universe, they affect other universes. And so either out of concern or out of greed or lust or wickedness or great good, they are coming through from one universe to another to interact with us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, so I want to go back. I want to continue with this, but I want to go back just a little bit where you said a watery planet came together with our physical planet here, our rock planet, more or less, or solid planet, and it created like a two planets within one.
Yes. There was a universal flood, and it actually took several years for just the waters to come to a balance on this Earth.
And this is the one that they speak of as far as Noah's flood.
That's correct. That action is actually the union of the polarity.
Now, the polarity of the, would it be the male and feminine energies, or?
That is a perfect representation. The yin and the yang, the cross, the vortex, all of these things in all civilizations refer to symbolically the same action.
And
the uniting of the two planets.
And now, if we had, this would have been before, let's see, this would be before Mu?
After.
After Mu.
After.
It'd be after Mu. Now, mm-hmm. Mu had, so the Earth still had water at that point in
yes,
time.
Yes, the Earth still had water, but it wasn't flooded.
Uh-huh.
It was probably enjoying a nice temperature equilibrium at the time, not tilted on a 23-degree axis.
Uh-huh. And then, so we did have people, so apparently there was people that did survive that, because even the Native Americans talk about people that had survived it. It seems to me that didn't some of the people even go underground?
Yes, they went underground, they went into caves, into mountains, and they did survive. And even in the Bible, it talks about Moses' people settling among the people of the earth.
Well, and then besides that, you know, when they talk about the sons of Noah, they went like for Ham, you know,
right.
He went and, you know, and found, you know, and he started up, his race, and so he had to found people, you
mm-hmm.
know, in order
it
to...
It didn't start with eight souls.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of the Christians, you know, as far as, you know, they take that whole story literally and think that that's what we had is
well,
what could have gotten...
The problem with their interpretation is, and I'm Christian as well,
uh-huh.
is that that's not the whole story.
Yeah.
That the word Bible isn't a book. It's Latin for library.
Yeah.
It's a collection of a few letters, a few epistles, some ancient documents. Isaiah is probably the most accurate of all of them, Old Testament stuff. But there's reams, volumes, whole shelves and libraries full of records that were not included in the Bible. And that decision was not made by anybody except the power structure.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we took a great loss with the burning of the Alexandria Library.
Sure. And they, of course, burned a lot of the translators in the Middle Ages, too.
Yeah. So now, with this union, did it create, because I've heard a lot of people say that Earth is the one, the only planet that is has psychic energy.
Well, it's the only planet close to ours.
I'm not talking about the people on Earth. I'm talking about the Earth as an entity of her own.
I still say the same thing. I think that the same intelligence that directed the construction of this planet has directed the construction of countless other planets. We just have not been able to travel to them or see them in our telescopes, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. You know, light travels at the speed of light through our known universe,
mm-hmm.
but the speed of thought much, much faster than that.
And that's what I've been, as you know, been really getting into lately is that quantum thought.
Quantum sight.
Quantum sight.
Yeah, I thought that was an excellent coinage by one of your...
That was me.
Oh, all right.
That was my article I wrote on quantum sight.
Well, there's a very good chapter on the book on that same thing called In the Interaction of the Universes.
Things are given to people, like I don't necessarily give myself credit, you know, for the term quantum sight. Because I know that there are those out there someplace that works within this realm that influences our thinking, you know, and they say, hey, here's an idea, you know, and like, and then people will pick up on that and they'll say, oh, wow, you know, what a brilliant idea I had. And it's not our idea at all. Because I know since I wrote that, it's just like all of a sudden, it's just like all these, the stuff is being dropped in my lap, you know, about, well, let's go with this idea, you know, an extension of this, an extension of that, add this, you know, like making a stew, you know, you throw a little salt and a little pepper, you know.
Introduction in the book, I say, and this has been my philosophy since I was a teenager, I've been castigated many times for it, everything we do will eventually affect the universe.
Yeah. So you think that all the planets have some sort of psychic energy?
I didn't say all the planets. I said there are some planets that have been directed, their construction has been directed and engineered the same way this one has.
Uh-huh.
We just can't detect them. I don't think...
Would be the definition of a live planet and a dead planet?
Yes.
Okay.
There's a lot of things I think that it takes, and I'm looking at this strictly from an astrophysical point of view. There are a lot of things that it takes to make a living planet. You've got to have an electrojet. You've got to have moving water through the atmosphere. We have millions and millions of gallons every hour that are moving around this planet by air. You've got to have an ionosphere to protect the planet from cosmic radiation so that life can exist without being anesthetized or an antiseptic surface. You've got to have protection. There's a rhythm, a vibration to this planet. It's difficult to explain on the radio, but there's a pulse to the planet.
Uh-huh. Well, vibration is perfect, you know.
I would almost say there's a voice to the planet.
Uh-huh.
And there are some people that are in tune with that and can care for the planet better than others.
Well, isn't that how Genesis starts it out? In the creation, the first was the Word.
Yes.
And I think the word is vibration.
Sure. And it says, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. And his face moved upon the face of the deep and divided the waters from the waters and placed a firmament between them. In those two sentences, you witness the birth of a new planet.
Okay, but, all right, so, and so we figured that it had to have been approximately about anywhere between 7,000 and 10,000 years ago.
Well, I don't know how long it took to form that planet, and I don't know how long Noah lived on that planet, but I do know 7,000 years ago that planet was united with this planet.
Now, with this planet that came, you said that it had all of this on it already, the animals.
Yes, but they were in a pure form, in a higher form. When you move from one universe to another universe, there is a different level of energy, a different level of glory between those two universes.
Uh-huh.
So when Noah's planet came here, it was of a different construction, a different ecology, a different anthropology than this planet.
Uh-huh.
And when they combined, the two ecologies had to balance one another.
So when they're talking about, in the Bible, and they're talking about the angels came to Noah and said that you have been chosen to build the ark, he wasn't even here on Earth.
That's right. He was on that Earth.
And then he rode that, and so he basically rode that planet here to this Earth.
That's correct. And we go into a lot of detail in that, in the book.
And of course, that's the Christians' account, because we don't even know for sure if that was his true name, Noah. That could be just a, or do we know for a fact that that was his name?
Well, as I say, I don't take sides on that.
Okay, so
we tried to find as many names as we could for him.
Okay, so there are many more names other than Noah, what I'm getting at. Okay.
Sure, because all the ancient observers had their own way of receiving the truth of what was going on, either by their own observation or by some spiritual contact.
Uh-huh. Well, I had heard through some sort of ancient writing that there had been a protective filament around the Earth, and it was water, and then it collapsed and it hit the Earth. But apparently that wasn't correct. But it was some. So, but apparently they must have gotten that type of information.
I've heard that theory too. That there, because of the temperature equilibrium, the Earth had been covered by a fog, and that it never rained.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard it described that the condition under which the flood occurred was actually Earth's collision with an ice asteroid that seeded the clouds, and the impact was such that it caused a polar shift and tilted the Earth 23 degrees on its axis, and by the time the weather came to equilibrium, man could see the stars and was much more exposed to cosmic radiation, and so his lifespan went from 900 years and something to about 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
But anthropologically, that does not hold water. It doesn't hold water paleo in the paleobiology or the paleobotany.
Mm-hmm. And now, does Elcyon work with this? or do you think that it came from that area up in the Orion constellation, Sirius, Sirius, or
Sirius is in the right direction, but we think that it actually came through the rift of the Milky Way, so it would have been closer to the center of the galaxy.
And
hundreds of light years away.
Now, and that's where they claim that Alcyone is the foundation, the center of the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes by a lot of names. Another one is Kolob.
What is it?
Kolob, K-O-L-O-B.
Okay. Okay, so I think that, for people that want to research something out like that, they need to get your book, Ark of the Millions of Years.
There are between 25 and 45 bibliographical references at the end of each chapter.
Uh-huh.
And the resources are excellent.
Okay, great. Now, let's go. And did you get those pictures, by the way, that I sent?
I sure did. Quite amazing.
That Eagle Lake, it's really something else, isn't it, up there?
Well, the one with the red laser beam between the craft.
Now, that one was right over our UFO center here.
It was absolutely stunning, just stunning. I looked at it for half an hour. I couldn't believe it.
It was just getting dawn, and I decided to take one last picture up there, and that's when I caught that picture. Now, with that laser beam going from one ship to that white sphere, that looked to me, that seems that that was transmitting and receiving messages.
That was an awful big laser beam of that wavelength to be seen.
Well, I couldn't see it. It only showed up on the camera.
How about that?
Yeah. I just shot up just hoping I'd catch something. I didn't see anything up there, as a matter of fact. But I'd known that there was a UFO in that area from shooting pictures earlier that night. I'd seen the light up there, so that's when I shot up there. But when I shot that picture, I didn't see anything except blue sky. And then when I uploaded it, there it was.
Absolutely remarkable.
Yeah. But, so you see, what about those pictures that I sent you on up there at Eagle Lake? There's a reason I'm asking you this, because I'm kind of leading into what we're going to get into next.
They almost look like multiple exposures. What I seem to see is a phasing of the visual information. Like you're phasing in between, I don't know, dimensions almost.
Yeah. See, those were all done with a digital camera.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah. See, we could explain it off if it was just a regular camera, with film. Then we could say, double exposure, something like that. But being that it was a digital, what it was, that right there is, a girl had contacted me and told me that there was a lot of UFOs working up in that area. And she was able to watch them at night. So I decided to go up there, and I just kind of went with my senses of where I felt that would be the best place to take pictures. And believe it or not, I found that portal right off the bat, right there at this boat landing. And when we started taking pictures, we just started getting some of the most craziest things.
Is there any kind of sensation that goes with it? Is there any kind of physical a sensation that you pick up when you're close to one of those?
Nope. we have noticed that afterwards, after we get home, maybe for a couple days, we'll be so tired, all we want to do is sleep,
Well,
you would think that you'd be charged, but it's just the opposite. It just seems like we're just drained.
As one well-trained in instrumental analysis, I would sure love to come up there sometime and see what I could detect and record.
Well, there was that one picture I sent you where there's a fog that goes around that one woman, and it almost looks like there's a tunnel, that she's kind of standing in front of a tunnel. And then, I told you to look at that, she's the woman with the white coat on, and then you can see standing just a little bit above her are these huge feet. you know, and legs.
Yeah, I thought, you know,
yeah, but just, but you see, if you notice, standing further back from her was a woman with a red coat on. That,
yes.
That is her large feet and legs.
How did that happen?
Well, I was hoping if I send you those pictures, you'd be able to figure it out.
Well,
because it almost seems, I don't know, for some reason I'm thinking, maybe what's there's like an interdimensional portal there, but there's also a UFO of sorts, or some sort of a vehicle there that's gathering information. So it's pulling in these images, and maybe the shutter speed isn't fast enough for us to be able to see the vibration of the UFO, but it's fast enough for us to catch these images that it's pulling up into that portal.
Well, the neat thing about CCDs is that the shutter speed's additive, so it's not like image emulsification. It actually takes a photon to make the CCD convert that into electronic information. What's probably happening is a phasing between the third and fourth dimensions. In the fourth dimension, all angles are visible at the same time.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, that makes sense then, because we've taken pictures where, you know, it will have like something like that's supposed to be facing east, and it'll turn that around where it's facing north or south.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that it can, you know, we're saying, well, how can that be? It's almost like a tornado, you know, how it'll take everything and just kind of like all spin it together, you know, like into a soup, you know.
That's a good analogy.
And
it is actually like a vortex like that.
Well, that's what it's doing, because we're picking up pictures that are not even in that area, you know, of the camera's view, and it'll be, when we take the picture, it'll be there.
Does it show up on digital video?
We haven't tried digital video. I think
that would be neat to just set up three or four digital video cameras and let them run for a couple of hours and
yeah.
Go up and move around in the area. You might be able to see.
Unfortunately, it zaps our batteries. I mean, when we go up there, we have to take all these batteries with us, because, boy, I'll tell you, a battery in a camera only lasts maybe sometimes 5 minutes and it's gone.
Really?
Yeah. It just,
that's amazing, too.
Yeah, just drains those batteries.
Something up there can be detected. I want to bring some equipment up there.
Oh, I told some of the girls that you might be coming up. You know, if you do come up, I mean, I'll make, you know, I'm pretty tight with my money, but I'll tell you, if you came up for what I have up there, I'll even front the hotel.
Well, I think the college would probably fund an expedition, but I have to outline it pretty clearly.
Yeah, but boy, we got some things. Did in that car? Did you see that car? With that silver car and all those multiple images coming up?
I didn't see the car.
Oh,
you sent me three images.
Yeah, I'll send that one to you. Yeah, because the car you can see is crystal clear. No blur whatsoever, but there's like hundreds of cars, you know, ripples. It looks like ripples of that same car, just hundreds of them coming off that car.
I know I saw the text of that, but I didn't see the picture. If it's on your website, I'll find it.
Yeah, no, it isn't, but I'll send it to you.
Yeah.
But so anyhow, the reason I brought this up is multi-dimensions.
Well, the second chapter in the book is called The Dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
And we cover that quite extensively. We even, in the interaction of the universes, we bring in OBEs and all of the clinical, well, a good study of the clinical data that's available was done over a 25-year period. I mean, the evidence is just overwhelming. And we make some conservative interpretations, not anything really liberal or outlandish, but to deny that things like remote viewing or what's called quantum sight by you, to deny that that exists is just burying your head in the sand.
Yeah, because, I mean, well, I have different people that send me photos, too, you know, and with their, thank God for digital cameras, you know.
That's great.
I love them. But where they've actually taken pictures and an OBE standing there, you know, a very, you know, let's say, ethereal, you know, they're not solid, But, I mean, there is no doubt what you're looking at,
right.
You know, is some sort of an entity. I have to send you did I send you that picture of that robot, or this robotic creature that was sitting up above on top of this building, looking down on our center?
No, I didn't see
that. Oh, well, I'll send that one to you, too. But
you have a wealth of information up there.
Oh, yeah, but my dog was acting crazy. And anyhow, so I decided, well, maybe there's some orbs outdoors or something, and he's kind of picking up on their energy. So I went outside, and I went to shoot some pictures, and there was this most amazing vortex that was going on, you know, it was activated out there, and just swirls of energy. And as I'm looking at it, I looked at the top of this building that's across the street from us, and you know, where the eave goes, you know, it should be all solid white, right? But there was like something, there was a break in the white. And I thought, well, what is that? And I took a better look at it, and what it was the legs of something sitting up there. And I took a better, you know, I put it in the photo editor and blew it up, and it was some sort of a robotic creature. And this thing was huge. I bet you he had been at least 15 foot, you know, if he was standing, it had been at least 15 foot, maybe 400 or 500 pounds, you know, and he was just sitting up there looking right down at me as I was taking these pictures.
That's amazing.
So, you know, because of digital, we're able to capture things like that. But like you said, you have to have a vortex, right?
Yes, and these vortexes exist all over the planet, and mm-hmm. the ancients paid very close attention to that. They existed along things called ley lines, and where they intersected, the vortexes were very powerful. And they would usually build some kind of temple or a synagogue or a place of worship or a place where they would do praying or meditating close to those vortexes. In the Mayan culture, those vortexes usually existed around large cave openings. And so there's all kinds of pictures that we have in the book of mosaics or masks or granite carvings that are done at the openings of these caves to denote that there's a powerful vortex there.
Well, you see, like up at Eagle Lake, where I've got those pictures that I sent you, you know, showing all those dimensions, we found out just recently that there was a quarry, you know, and for some reason, they flooded that quarry in, you know, and you know, they extended the lake, but they... So we suspect that that's why the vortex there is. It's because of that quarry, maybe, in the crystalline deposits.
Isn't there an ancient excavation site up near where you live?
That's the one.
Where 500,000 tons of copper were mined out of there? And yet
that's further north. That's up, I think, in Michigan.
Yeah.
Up in the Great Lake area.
There's no roads, there's no towns, there's no ancient ruins of any kind of crew that might have lived there, and yet somehow 500,000 tons of copper ore got mined out of it.
Right, and we suspect, you know, from going with the timetable and everything, this was going on the same point of time as King Solomon, and we suspect that the copper was being mined for King Solomon's temple.
Interesting. Well, it would have had to have been moved from mm-hmm. where it was mined to where it was used.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have evidence here that from the Great Lake area all the way down through here, Ohio, and down into Florida, or you know, down into the Gulf area, that ancient people they made artificial waterways. Now we see them as rivers because they're still working, you know, because I imagine when they made the waterways, they made them off lakes, you know, lakes and larger tributaries. But
so they floated the copper out of it?
Uh-huh, and they took it right down through they were mining, and then they were and using those artificial waterways.
Interesting that you should mention King Solomon. One of the, the astrological event that heralded the birth of King Solomon was known as the Grand Sextile Astrological Formation, six planets arrange themselves in a Star of David with Earth in the center. The next time that that occurred was November of 2003,
yeah,
which is when we finished the book. And that's why the formation is on the cover of the book.
Yeah, I've seen that. So that was 2003. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have been, it was just about that time that all of a sudden your UFO sightings have just been picked up.
Yeah.
Tremendously all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, in the last couple of months, I don't know if you've been on my website lately, but
it's everywhere.
Yeah, I had to actually turn around and start doing a daily UFO report, you know, broadcast, because it used to be that, you know, years back, you know, you could do UFO reports like once a month, you know, and cover them. Then it got to be once a week, and now I'm doing it once a day because I have to, just to even, you know, just even get close to as how many sightings there are. And I'm telling everybody, hey guys, well, wake up and smell the roses. These guys are back. They're here.
And that's happening all over China. It's happening,
yeah,
over Indonesia, around where the earthquake was. It's happening in Russia. It's happening in the Midwest, where you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think I heard something recently of Mexico City.
Yeah, and they're positioning themselves. You know, before it used to be like random sightings, but like here in this area, we have been seeing UFOs every night. With no exception, of course, like every once in a while, you know, it's foggy or something, you just can't see your hand in front of your nose. But if it's not foggy, I guarantee anybody that comes here, they can see a UFO. And
well,
and the same thing's happening in Phoenix, Arizona. And see, we started having our sightings in July. Phoenix, Arizona started having their sightings in July. California's doing the same thing. And then there's another person that contacts me up in Frederick, Wisconsin. He's been having sightings since July. And I would imagine they probably came back just about when you said 2003, with that, that would make sense, that it was when the planetary alignments were just right.
Well, the one unique thing about this grand sextile formation, as compared to the one that happened 5,000 years ago, is that during this one, there was a full lunar eclipse.
Mm-hmm. And what does Revelation say? Watch the skies. The signs will be there right in the skies.
They call it the sign of the Son of Man.
Mm-hmm. So I would, man, and what was it? And then, of course, we had the Venus transit here.
Yes.
When was that? That was last year, 2004, May. I believe it was May 2004. And that's the twin of the one for 2012.
Yeah, December 2012,
mm-hmm,
the end of the Mayan calendar.
Right. And I know that Mayan elders just got here out recently, a statement for everyone that things are going to be happening as of now.
Well, we were just down there. We were just down there this last fall, and we were at Chichen Itza. And we were talking with some of the locals down there. I speak a little bit of Spanish, and my co-author knows an expedition leader down there pretty well. And she asked him, you know, what exactly does happen December of 2012? I mean, is it the end of the calendar, the beginning of a new one? And he said one word. Boom.
Really? Huh. Well, that's scary.
I think that translates in just about any language.
Yeah.
Put it this
there's
way.
Not too much to say about that, huh?
I'm not buying any green bananas.
Yeah. Well, I think that Earth is going to be going through a transformation and going more into an ethereal state. And to me, the only way that you can go from physical to ethereal is, you know, when you die.
Yes, and there's a couple ways of doing that, too.
And how do you mean?
Well, there's a condition called transfiguration, which is a temporary change in the human body to be able to withstand a shift from one level of glory or one universe to another on a temporary basis.
Uh-huh.
And then there's another process called translation, where you don't actually go through the process of dying. You're changed from one form into another form. And according to the records, it says in the twinkling of an eye.
Right.
But few people have had the need to undergo that kind of change. But there are a few. There are records of a few. And the last is resurrection.
Uh-huh. Now, so you don't think that this... But we're supposed to have another age after this. We're right now in the fourth age, right?
And then there's the fifth age. Almost every religion has a record of that. Some call it the millennium. Some call it the fifth age. Some, I think I've even heard it called the ninth age in some records. There's different ways of measuring it, different ways of interpreting it. But I think what we're looking at here is almost a degeneration of a record of common origin that's very, very ancient. We haven't lost it completely, but I don't think we have a crystal clear picture of it either.
But with the Venus transit, if I'm remembering it right, what it was supposed to do was to reactivate the DNA of Earth and the people of Earth, where we start to remember again the things that we had forgotten, whereas all things will once again be revealed, so that we may prepare ourselves for the coming of 2012. Am I correct?
Turning the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children of the fathers.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, you certainly see the fever.
Well, I'm definitely seeing a buildup of this war. There's a lot of us that believe that we actually went into an intergalactic and spiritual war December 23rd. You know, and then there'll be another war in March again. Well, I guess it's just basically the White Lodge against the Black Lodge, you know, according to the, the Templars and that.
Well, there's no doubt that the forces of good and evil have been unleashed on the Earth as they have never been before.
Yeah, and then the Senghais, they claim that the void will be dumped in April of this year. And the void is what carries everything, you know, all the you know, all these entities that a lot of us have never ever seen before. It's another dimension of some sort, and anyhow they suppose it, and apparently Earth is the planet closest to this void. So anyhow, this is to be the battlefield, you know.
Well, you and I will be here to see it and participate in it.
Well, I guess that from, you know, as far as the listeners are concerned, just remember one thing. As souls, we all chose to be here at this time.
That's correct. So it
is an honor. You know, it's nothing for us to fear, because if that was the case, we would have never came back to be here.
All right. Somehow we kept our first estate and earned the right to be here.
Yeah. And so we've got the Atlanteans are back, the Lemurians are back.
Well, that's why it's important to get this book out when it...
I am going to promote your book and your work like I have never promoted something before. I am going to make sure that everybody hears about this book, and I'll put something up on my website about it too. But as far as I'm concerned, and to the listeners, you all have to get this book. I'm still waiting for my book, but I'm sure it's going to be here any day now. And I'm going to read it from page one to the end, and probably five times more, because But this missing key, are you going to give us any hint on that?
it isn't as clear something that I can divulge on the radio and somebody would say, oh, I don't need to buy the book.
Oh.
It is just the restoration of ancient knowledge that was lost for over 5,000 years. And it's in the chapter called The Union of the Polarity. And it's probably the longest chapter in the book, and I can't go into a lot of details on it. Just difficult to do in even an hour show.
Well, now, also, going back to interdimensional portals and realms, now, a lot of us speak of the veil, and that the veil is thinning, and at some point in time, maybe 2012, who knows, or maybe even this year, I don't know, but at some point in time, third dimension will collapse, you know, into the fourth, and, or into the higher dimensions.
Yeah, it's called rolling together as a scroll.
Now, is what's your opinion on that?
Well, the veil, there are several veils on the earth, and it is true, they are thinning, and there are beings moving back and forth through that veil. This is the time. This is the what was originally termed the dispensation of the fullness of times. This is the time that every prophet that has ever lived on the face of the earth prophesied about. This is it. This is the time. And so, yes, the veil between the universes, the dimensions, the heavens, we have all kinds of names for it, it is thinning. And, you know, people that think that mortality is everything there is in the universe are just fooling themselves. We are spiritual beings having a mortal experience, and we need to realize that.
Now, and we're not the only ones participating in this,
right?
The Earth, and when I say we, I'm talking about the people of Earth. This it's an intergalactic, interdimensional,
interuniversal,
and so, and because of it, we should be expecting to see more and more as far as contact goes with other beings, whether it be ultra-dimensional, interdimensional, extraterrestrial, right?
Well, I don't really know how to stress this, and I don't want to sound like anything other than the scientist that I am. But you have to have, for lack of a better term, a vibrational condition about your body to be able to sense these presences.
Yeah.
You can call it being in tune with the spirit. You can call it karma. You can call it all kinds of different words. But every human that is within sound of my voice knows what I'm talking about. There are times when you feel in harmony, and there are times when you feel in conflict. These feelings are important. And if you are conflicted and chaotic and full of wickedness, you are not going to see these things. They're going to pass right by you.
Well, now, where does that leave our world leaders and these people that are that have been of the old age, the ones in power that have dictated the people since the beginning of our memory?
I don't really know. I think there are good men in that group. I know some congressmen. I know some senators. I think they're good men. I think that they're not caught up in the power and the glory of their own position. They're humble. They're listening just like everybody else. But I also think there are people that are definitely caught up in the power, caught up in the trappings of the glory of men. And to them, I think they're going to miss the boat. They're not going to see what's happening, as I think a vast majority of the people are going to be in that boat. I heard this in a movie one time called Joe versus the Volcano, but it's so profound, I can't help but quote it. The vast majority of the world is asleep, but there are a few of us that are awake and live in a constant state of amazement.
Yeah. Now, before we conclude tonight, what do you want to talk about as far as your book's concerned? Because,
well,
I know that you said there's 500 pages, and we probably only covered maybe two chapters here.
No, we actually mentioned about six or seven chapters. We had the interaction of the universes. We had the dimensions. We had the union of the polarity. We talked about the giants. We've talked about the lost civilization of Atlantis and Mu. So there's a chapter on each one of those subjects, and there's a lot of detail in there. But the thing that I want to say at this point is, Mary, I'm absolutely humbled that that you feel the way that you do and that you say that you're going to help me get this book out. And I really don't know what to say.
I believe in you. And I haven't read the book, but everything you've told me so far, I've got that gut feeling that I need to turn around and work with you on this to get this message out.
Well, truth is truth. And I really don't want anybody to be prejudiced against it, or I know it's going to be controversial, but aren't we the fans of Burlington News, of Ancient Mysteries, aren't we controversial?
Yeah. And what can we do for people that are media that are listening, because we have a lot of media that listens as well. What should we do to help prepare the people for this coming time? Do you have any ideas?
Boy, that invokes a lot of thought. I don't want to take advantage of the moment and just say, well, you need to buy the book, because I think that'll come across as me profiteering off of it. Far be it from that. You know, we didn't approach the largest publishers, and we're not made of a lot of money. We didn't go print 100,000 copies of this book and stick it in everybody's mailbox. We published this on a small press with humble beginnings, with our hearts in it, and we poured our research into it, and I think it's a good work. And it's difficult to judge men, difficult to judge women, but we are given to be fruit inspectors. So all I'm asking your fans to do and the media to do is just inspect the fruit.
Okay. Now let me read a little bit off your website. The Ark of a Millions of Years. New discoveries and light on the creation by E.J. Clarke and B. Alexander Agnew, Ph.D. The Earth isn't from around here. As a fulfillment of prophecy, these uniquely qualified authors bring all of the pieces together in one inspiring landmark literary work. The Ark of a Millions of Years is written with great literary style and the punch of theoretical physicists. Where is heaven? Who were the giants? Where did the earth really come from? You always wanted to know. Read the book. Evolution and creationism together at last. And you can find this book and more on the authors at arcofmillionsofyears.com. And
of course, the book is available at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or Borders. And you can go to the website and click through directly to the publisher for about a 10 to 15% discount.
Okay. And I want you to talk to the college there and see if they can't get you up there.
I'll do that.
And if they don't, you know, like I said, you know, I'll help, you know, as best as I can, because it, you know, very seldom does anyone find a portal as remarkable as this one, you know, and it's active, and I think it's been active for some time, and I'm sure it's going to stay active, but we need, you know, somebody a little bit more advanced than myself and my researchers to really go in there and find out what's going on, and if it gives us any sort of insight as to what's going on in the other dimensions, you know, it'll be an asset for everyone. The world, you know.
And with your permission, I'll make some contacts in my scientific community to see if I can pull some of those that have more expertise than I do in detecting these ethereal forces. I'm more of an instrumental analysis guru in spectroscopy and gamma spectroscopy, radio spectroscopy, and I can do that much, but I have a couple of experts that have a lot of experience in this kind of interviewing and investigation, and they're pretty independent, so with your permission, I'll contact them as well.
Oh, you more than have my permission, because I just want somebody, you know, I don't want any fame or profit off of it, but I mean, it's been God-given to us, you know, and it's like, here it is, folks, you know, now learn to read it, you know, and who knows what it has to really offer us. You know, I don't have the slightest clue of what this portal, the information this portal's even putting out, let alone taking in. But I know it's there, as you've seen in those photos.
I just am fascinated by the possibility of being able to take a peek through it and see what's on the other side.
Yeah. Well, I'm not quite that brave enough, but I guess we've gone through it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be getting the pictures that we got, you know. But if we have, you don't really physically know it.
Well,
but like I said, the next day, for days afterwards, you can...
You're witnessing the interaction of the universes.
Mm-hmm. Well, bless you. And I'm glad that you're a member of Ancient Mysteries MS, and I look forward to all your posts, and please, listeners, get this book, and I'll have more out on this book as time goes by, and the more I'm able to pick Brooke's brain, the more I'll be able to share with you readers.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Okay. And that's it, folks. Make sure that you stop at www.burlingtonnews.net and listen to our show. Remember, this is on-demand radio, so you'll be able to hear this show here for the next month. As a matter of fact, chances are I'll probably keep this show up permanently so that all of you will be able to hear it. Most of my shows after a month go into archive, but because of the importance of this one, I might be keeping it up on a regular basis. Okay, and it was nice talking to all of you, and remember, keep your eyes to the sky and your cameras handy.